Today's podcast is brought to you by our awesome patrons at patreon.com and by Audible. Get a free audiobook download and a 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/Saratalk. Over 180,000 titles to choose from in all your favorite genres. Take advantage of this special promotion. Go to audibletrial.com/Saratalk and download your free audiobook today.
You're listening to Saratalk. It's political.
This rhetoric about make America great again. Tell me when America was great and we'll go back there. I'm going with you.
Critical.
Hang on. Let me change some words here. All right, ready?
Adults with religious confusion who truly believe in a higher power that created us and actually cares what we do with our penises and vaginas should be treated with care, compassion, and kindness, but must not be officially affirmed in their confusion, no matter how sincerely held.
Fuck you.
And positively LGBT positive.
In many states, you can still be evicted from housing simply for being gay or transgender. Stand and fight with us.
Oh, and occasionally, completely absurd.
You women have a flame coming out of your vagina. You talk about being hot. Well, you sure not gonna be hot. You're gonna have a flame shooting out of your vagina. You're gonna need asbestos panties to stop that.
And now, from Orlando, Florida, your host, Sarah Austin.
Hey everybody, Sarah Austin here. Welcome to Sarah Talk. This is episode number 40. We do have a special guest with us on the phone today. Danica Rome is a journalist turned political candidate running for Virginia's House of Delegates in the June 13th Democratic primary. Danica, welcome to Sarah Talk.
Thank you so much for having me, Sarah. It's so nice to talk to you.
The pleasure is all ours. First, let's share a little brief background. You're a lifelong resident there in Virginia and 10 years as a news journalist.
So I'm a lifelong resident of Manassas, Virginia. In good traffic, Manassas is located about an hour southwest of Washington, D.C.
Uh-huh.
It's really close to Interstate 66. It's not too far away from Interstate 95. So this is a really large community in Prince William County, where the county itself has more than 420,000 residents, and two nearby jurisdictions, the city of Manassas and the city of Manassas Park, also have several tens of thousands more people. So we have more than 500,000 people living within our general larger Prince William County area. And that makes us the second largest locality or second largest county in northern or in all of Virginia, only trailing Fairfax County. We have roughly the same size population as the city of Virginia Beach and Hampton Roads. Meanwhile, so I've been a journalist for the last 10 and a half years. I took a sabbatical so I could run for office, and the sabbatical will go for 6 months if things go poorly, and it'll go for, you know, maybe years if it goes well. I don't know.
Yeah, as long as it needs to, yeah.
Yeah.
So I will attest, I've worked in news talk radio once upon a time, and local news media really is like a public service field. It's all about learning your audience, what they're interested in, what they hold important. Are you finding that that translates well with the conversations you're having with voters in the district?
100%. There's no question in my mind that being a local journalist and having done print reporting for, you know, my local papers for 10 and a half years, that has absolutely 100% given me the skill set to do this job in terms of how to reach out to people, how to actually have a conversation and listen to people who you talk to and incorporate their ideas into the campaign. That's a huge, huge part of just the entire campaign. Like, one of the things I talk about is, so I have three main issues, which are transportation, economic development, and education. But we also have some other, you know, very specialized local issues in Prince William County. So, for example, on transportation, there was a proposal that would have a rural, that would have a road go through what's known as the Rural Crescent in northwestern Prince William County. And the problem with that is it would go through a ton of private property. It would cause a massive amount of environmental damage, lots of other problems. Well, the residents there made their voices very loud and very clear that they were opposed to this road. But so often what we've had in government is that we have top-down ideas where basically the residents are told, this is your option, or these are your, you get to, here's five proposals, pick the one that you hate the least.
Yeah.
That comes up all the time. The same thing happened when Dominion Virginia Power, which is a local utility company here, proposed extending its power lines west from Gainesville over to Haymarket so that they could provide power for what they were saying was an unnamed customer out at a data center. Well, I was the reporter who named names and said, that's actually owned by Amazon. And the proposals that they put forward, if you were a resident in that area, you said, hey, we want that to be buried below ground and we want Amazon to pay for it. Well, that was like one of five options that came up way late after the entire talk had been about above ground power lines because they were the, you know, least expensive and whatever other, you know, reasons for it. It's just like you look at this stuff and it's like, you know, maybe if the people who had proposed the Bicentennial Parkway, maybe if the people who had proposed this utility extension had talked to the residents first and said, okay, folks, here's the situation. We have a customer here that needs power. What is acceptable to you? What is unacceptable to you? If they had gone door to door and physically talked to all the people in that area, if they had gone door to door over on Pageland Lane when they were talking about Bi-County Parkway, and they said, okay, what's acceptable? No, it's not acceptable. They would have been able to find a consensus so much earlier. They would have actually been able to come up with a proposal that people would have liked. But all the time in government, this happens, where you have the people at the top say, all right, folks, here's your, you know, here's our Russian roulette gun right here, and there's five bullets in the chamber. Spin it and good luck.
Right.
And it's just like, you've got to be kidding. We've got to do better than that. And as a journalist, I covered those stories in depth for a long time. I did a lot of power line stories, not just 2 years ago, but also in 2006 when another thing came up like that. And I covered roads for more than 9 years. And I look at that and I say, okay, what's the learning issue? What's the learning experience that I get out of that? The learning experience that I get out of it is when I want to deal with major public projects, especially for transportation, we need to get the residents' voices first, then make our pitch.
Right. What a novel idea.
Right.
So there is a component of your identity that if you move on into the general may become a point of contention. You, as I, are transgender. And now, of course, being transgender is only a very small part of our identities. But if you wouldn't care to share a little bit, your self-discovery, coming out, social, family, workplace transition, I'd love to hear some of that story.
Yeah, sure. So basically, I started figuring it out pretty well by the time I was in fifth grade that something was up because I was not like the cisgender boys in class. But at the same time, by seventh grade is when I knew for sure. On the other hand, I did Catholic schools for 13 years, and growing up in the mid-90s, or well, just throughout the 90s in general, I didn't have any transgender role models. I didn't have people to look up to. I didn't know any LGBT people in my life at all. And I mean, I went to a high school with more than 1,000 people, and I knew of one person who was out at the time, just out as gay anyway.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't just simply put it. Having other people with that identity, or just LGBTQ identity in general, wasn't present every day in my life. And so it was really hard to, you know, overcome fear and overcome a lot of other stuff and not wanting to disappoint my family. So I stayed closeted and, you know, I tried dating women. It never worked. I tried, just expressing myself in, you know, whatever various masculine personas I could. When I was a kid, it was through playing baseball and loving baseball so much to the point where I could look at a baseball card and see, you know, the blades of grass on the field and be able to tell you which stadium it was from, you know, or when I was throughout my 20s being in heavy metal band, which I still am in, but, you know, for that, being on stage and just I'll be able to drink the most. I'll be able to be the loudest and to be the most, you know, the funniest person I can be and try to bring everyone in. On the one hand, I was treating alcohol like the great igniter, a great way for everyone to come together to make friends and to meet friends. And so in that regard, I don't have regrets about it. But on the other hand, I was also undergoing a toxic display of masculinity that was not working for me whatsoever. It was, no matter how hard you partied, no matter how loud you are on stage, no matter how wild of the night you had, still feel the same way every night when you go to bed.
Yep.
You still feel the same way every morning the next day. And you're walking with your friends and you walk past the store and the clothes there are beautiful and you want to try them on. You was like, oh my God. But you know that if you said anything about it, you'd just be ripped on. So you keep on going. And that storefront, that happened throughout my teens, throughout my 20s. And just the idea of how come this is forbidden for me? How come I can't go there? And I would have, you know, once I got into college, that's when I met, I think, so many of my, you know, girl dash friends who were so incredibly kind and really into the idea of, hey, you be you, express yourself for yourself. So I could only do it in little bursts, you know, just like going out dancing at, you know, a gay club in Buffalo or something for the night, like Marcella's, or going out for, you know, an industrial metal concert, you know, somewhere in Ithaca, or, you know, just doing something like that where I could explore my identity while at the same time being in a safe environment to do it. And after the Pulse shooting happened, I just cried and cried and cried. And one of the reasons for that was I felt like our space, the place where people like me had gone for so many decades to just express themselves, where it is supposed to be safe. It's the one place where when you're trans, when you're, you know, gay, however it is that you want to, you know, identify yourself as, it's the one place where you can go and just let loose, to just be yourself, not be judged for it, except for maybe in a sassy way of like, girl, look at that hair, you know, just like something fun. Like I remember being at a gay club in Richmond when I was probably 18, 19 years old. And, you know, I was, and one of the funny things about, you know, you go to, you know, gay clubs is the gender markers on the door are really suggestions. And they're not really exactly enforced. And so it's less like, you know, you go into the women's room and you'll have, you know, two gay men there and why? Well, no one's a threat to anyone there.
Right.
It's just like fun. It's just community, right? And so you walk in the door there and these two guys are just like, girl, look at your hair. This is so pretty, but you did not do it upright. Come on. Stand right here. And they just played with my hair until it was gorgeous.
Yeah.
Like, oh my God, this is great. So I would have bits of being able to come out. I would have bits of being able to express myself. But like when I was in middle school, I was the kid who would secretly record Too Long Foo, Thanks for Everything, Julie Newmar, and, you know, keep the volume super, super low at like 1:30 in the morning to go downstairs and watch it on VHS and, you know, just like try to listen as close as I could without trying to wake anyone else up and just be like, oh my God, look at Chi-Chi Rodriguez. She looks amazing. And just like feeling like I want this. I want this so bad. And I had no way of expressing it for so long. And it took until I was 28 years old before I finally started seeing a psychologist who specializes in transgender issues. And she's been phenomenal ever since. So I started that November 21st, 2012. I started hormone replacement therapy December 3rd, 2013. I started laser hair removal for my face on February 26th, 2013, so a little bit before. And it's completely, fundamentally changed my life.
Yeah.
I'm still sarcastic. I'm still nerdy about heavy metal and politics. You know, I still love road trips. I still have the core parts of my personality intact. Mm-hmm. But coming out has allowed me to just be myself and present as myself no matter the setting. So it's not like I have to change clothes when I'm driving home.
Yes.
Which,
oh my
when
God.
You're trans, you learn how to do.
Yes.
And it's like, I don't have to worry about, oh, if I go into this bathroom and change here, will it be weird if I come out, you know, as a different gender than how I entered, or, you know, presenting as a different gender than how I entered? You know, you don't have to worry about that fear now. Now it's just, you know, whether I'm in front of my boyfriend and my stepdaughter, whether I'm in front of my family, whether I'm in front of a source, you know, doing, you know, as a journalist, whether I was at the, you know, the protest against the Muslim ban yesterday in D.C., walking from White House to the Capitol, I look like myself all the time. Mm-hmm. I speak like myself all the time now. That doesn't change. And all that allows me to do is just have a more powerful voice to say, hey, people like us, we're not threats. we're just trying to live our lives. And so my message to politicians is protect our rights. But if you can't protect us, then just leave us alone.
Yeah.
Just leave us alone.
You know, it's amazing what we can do, what we can accomplish when that anxiety is allowed to just melt off and to truly just be yourself. It's amazing what you can focus on and get done.
Right, absolutely. And, you know, and my run for the Virginia House of Delegates right now, I'm running against someone in Delegate Bob Marshall who filed 4 anti-LGBT bills this year, including 2 anti-transgender bills, just explicitly anti-transgender bills, both of which died in subcommittee as predicted. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, without a question. And so he's been in office for 25 years. Yep. And he's the author of the state's now unconstitutional amendment against marriage equality. And I look at this and say, you know what hasn't happened in his 25 years of running this? An LGBT person directly opposing him.
Mm-hmm.
There hasn't been that voice in the room. Now, last year in 2015, Don Shaw, the Democratic candidate who ran against him, you know, has LGBT members of his family. So, you know, that was a very personal issue for him. At the same time, the contrast, the immediate contrast that I bring to the race here is as someone who worked for the newspaper for 9 years, for the Gainesville Times and the Prince William Times, covering the issues of the 13th District, writing more than 2,500 stories about Prince William County, and, you know, just everything else that kind of came with that, you know, for, again, more than 9 years. I'm a lifelong resident of Manassas. I'm 32 years old. I was born at Prince William Hospital in Manassas. I've gone to, you know, I was baptized, confirmed, and went to school at the same church that Delegate Marshall still practices at. And, I mean, same Catholic church that Delegate Marshall still practices at. I covered his campaigns in 2007, 2009, 11, 13, mm-hmm. 15. I've interviewed him more times than I can remember. I mean, I've interviewed him while I was overseas and still had to get my job done, because when you're a local journalist, or if you're on vacation, doesn't mean you're on vacation. Yeah. You still have a paper to put out. I mean, I interviewed him from, I think I was in Copenhagen. and so it's like, I always had at least a cordial, respectful relationship with Delegate Marshall while I was interviewing him, you know, while I was doing my job, even if inside his worldview was entirely anathema to mine in so many ways when it came to how we treat and talk about LGBT people, especially. Mm. And so it was like, well, what's the bigger consequence of that? And then I look, okay, last year he introduced 41 bills to the House of Delegates as a chief patron. One passed. And over the last 5 years, he's introduced 162 bills to the House of Delegates. 152 of them did not pass.
There's a guy earning his paycheck.
Right. And I said, well, actually, one of my points exactly. I say, well, how come? Well, he has no committee chairmanships after 25 years, despite being number 6 in seniority as a member of a 2-to-1 majority mm-hmm. party. And he has the futility rating of a freshman member of the minority party. And I go, why is that the case? Well, he spent so much time on go nowhere, dead on arrival, anti-LGBT bills, on abortion bills, on, you know, just whatever cause he had that week, that he is no longer effective on the core issues affecting the people of the 13th district. He's Route 28, for example, runs through the heart of his district. It goes through Yorkshire and goes through parts of Manassas. And that road was terrible in 1992 when he took office, when my car was made, I don't come from money, okay? And when my mom would be driving up to work and I would sit in the back of her car when on days when I didn't have school, and it was just an absolute mess. And 25 years later, that road is still terrible. While VDOT took care of removing traffic lights north of Centerville and widened the road in Manassas and southward, the part that runs through the 13th district, nothing's changed. It's still bad after 25 years. And you go, Elliot Marshall, you have your number one priority has to be taking care of this road, because thousands of people commute from the district along this road every single day. It's not enough to just advocate for change. You have to get results. And in Prince William County, we don't accept the idea that one of our state legislators can't get road funding, because we had Senator Chuck Colgan, who served for 40 years, longest state senator ever in Virginia, and he brought home money for so many infrastructure projects, from the Prince William County Parkway to raising Route 28 over Wellington Road and train tracks over Manassas, to widening Route 28 in the southern part of, or the western part of the county, over toward Knoxville, to widening the bridge over 123, or at 123 going into Fairfax. There's piece after piece after piece that he contributed to, bringing in two community colleges along with the George Mason campus, Innovation Technology Park, or right next to it. And you say, what happened? Why was Senator Colgan so successful? How come Delegate Harry Parrish was so successful at bringing infrastructure to our area? As a Democrat and Republican between Chuck and Harry, what did they do right? And then you look at Delegate Marshall and you go, what's different?
Well, and that's my question. What is it that's keeping him in that seat for 25 years if he's filing these go-nowhere legislation and doing nothing positive either?
Well, so that's the most asked question I get on the campaign trail.
I bet.
Is how come he keeps getting reelected every 2 years? Now, a lot of people who live in the district, who live in the 13th district, they'll tell you that they know where he stands, and that he says what he means what he says. Mm. I don't dispute that at all. In fact, I say, well, that's the issue. When he starts saying that, you know, whatever anti-LGBT thing this week, that means that he's going to be focusing on that issue, no matter if it's going to, you know, make it out or not. So there is a perception of Delegate Marshall that he delivers for people. And that's the problem. Maybe if you are allied with him, he will stand stronger for you than anyone else. Mm. But if you're not someone within his select group, then no, he doesn't advocate for you, and he actively fights against your own rights. I mean, keep in mind how many LGBT constituents he has throughout Manassas Park, Yorkshire, Manassas, Gainesville, and Haymarket. There's so many of us. I mean, I've been collecting petition signatures from them myself. I literally have their names and addresses. And I go, what's going on here?
Well,
let me
throw some numbers out here. In terms of spending, in 2015, you mentioned Democrat Don Shaw. Don Shaw outspent Bob Marshall 2-1 in 2015.
Yep.
And this is all of this is according to the Virginia Public Access Project, VPAP.org.
Yay, VPAP. And, I love VPAP.
And yet, Bob still lost, Bob still won by 1,500 votes. In 2013, the Democratic challenger outspent Marshall nearly 3-1, and that race fell by only about 500 votes. Now, 2015 was a lower voter turnout year, but 500 votes? I mean, flipping the seat seems very achievable.
All right, so here's what you need to know on top of that. And if you went back to the 2009 race, when now Delegate John Bell ran against him prior to redistricting, I mean, Delegate Bell far outspent him. But Delegate Marshall doesn't have to raise a ton of money to be competitive. He has to raise, you know, six figures to be competitive. Mm-hmm. But when you have 25 years of incumbency, that comes with higher name ID.
Right.
And so you go, okay, let's look at the district now and where it is now. Well, since 2011, since redistricting, we've added more than 8,000 new residents to the area, or 8,000 new voters within the 13th district. Six out of the last seven statewide Democratic candidates have won the 13th district. Hillary Clinton carried it by more than 14 percentage points. And you say, okay, so clearly the numbers are there to win. Since Adam Carney ran in 2013 when he lost by 498 votes out of more than 17,000 votes cast, we've added another 2,000 voters to the rolls in the 13th district.
Yeah.
So we say, okay.
Yeah.
Since then, we've clearly closed the gap. The numbers are there to win this year. How do we do it? The Democratic voters of the 13th district have to check all four boxes on the ballot.
Yep.
That's how we do it. You can't just look at governor, check Ralph Northam or Tom Perriello's name there, and then leave it alone. We've got to make it through lieutenant governor, through attorney general, and House of Delegates. When voter turnout is high, Democrats win.
Yes.
We already know this.
Yep.
We already know this. The higher the turnout this year, the more likely I'll be able to win, the more likely the three Democrats at the top of the ticket will be able to win. And right now, Democrats hold all five statewide positions in Virginia, governor, lieutenant governor, attorney general, and both U.S. Senate seats. We can't lose any of those.
Right.
It's so important. And given that redistricting is coming up soon, it is coming up in 4 years.
Republicans love to draw new lines.
We have to win this year in the House of Delegates. There are 17 seats that Hillary Clinton won that a Republican incumbent currently holds. If we want to have a voice in 2019, we know that in 2019, voter turnout will be lower than this year. Which means that if you're a Democrat, in order to win in 2019, you more than likely have to be an incumbent.
Mm-hmm.
You have to win the seats this year in order to make it through 2019, because that's just the nature of the beast. So what we're striving to do here is make sure that we capitalize on the turnout this year, make sure that our message is as sharp as can be, and that every day on the campaign trail, I'm talking about fixing Route 28, and we can do it without raising taxes. I'm talking about bringing high-paying jobs to Innovation Technology Park so our local residents don't have to commute on Route 28 and I-66 every single day. They can work in the same communities that they live in. I'm talking about raising teacher pay so that in the city of Manassas Park and Prince William County, it's not the lowest in Northern Virginia, which is unacceptable in an area as wealthy as ours. I'm talking about how can we push back against discrimination while at the same time focus on the core issues affecting the most people and the quality of life of the residents of the 13th district. And as a journalist, I know how to stay on message. As you know, a lifelong resident of Manassas, I know what the issues are in the 13th district. As a transgender woman, I know why it's important to make Virginia a more inclusive commonwealth. And as a stepmom, it's really important that every kid feel safe in school. Every child should feel safe in school, have their privacy respected, regardless of whether they're gay or straight, trans or cis. Every child should feel respected, should feel safe in school. That matters a lot. And I think that, you know, by having more non-discrimination protection for LGBTQ people in general, that helps out everyone. It doesn't just help us out.
Because absolutely.
Then you have people actually being their authentic sense of self, living as their authentic sense of self every day. So you then know who, you actually know who your neighbor is. You actually know who your classmate is. You know who your colleague is. In Virginia, you can be fired from your job for being LGBT, and that's okay with the government right now. You can be denied housing because we don't have that protection. There's a lot of issues right now in Virginia where we're completely inadequate on LGBT issues, including health care. We have got to treat LGBT health care as health care, not an option, not cosmetic, not, oh, do you really need this? I know what it's like to get a letter from the third-party group between the insurance company and myself saying that CareFirst was not going to cover my transition-related medical expenses mm-hmm. because it wasn't a part of their Virginia Health Group plan. And sorry, and it's just like, why?
Yeah.
That's so not okay. That's so not okay on so many levels. What, this goes right back into the narrative. What, do they think this is cosmetic? Mm. Do they think that this is just like, oh, you know, I just feel like going through lifelong suffocating dysphoria, and that's fine. It's just a choice.
Right.
You know, you got to be kidding me. Who would want to go through this?
Yes.
Do you not understand what it's like to basically have an imaginary hand grip your throat and over the years slowly, ever so slowly, tighten its grip until you basically feel like you can't breathe anymore? That's what dysphoria is like, and it never goes away. Even when you have transitioned, even when, you know, you look the way that you want to look, if you're that fortunate, it never goes away, because you know that's the only route that's sustainable for you.
Yep.
When you start transitioning, there's a lot of questions and a lot of fear. You don't know how HRT is going to take. You don't know if you decide to pursue surgery. You don't know, you know, how that's going to end up. But you do know that the path you're on is unsustainable, and you have to do something about it. And that is the something. The WPATH standards of care are the something.
Absolutely.
Far too often, we have trans issues, we have LGBT issues that are just not being treated the way that all other healthcare is treated. It's time that we flip the script on that argument.
Now, we're coming up on our break time here. Are you able to stick around with us for a little bit longer?
Yeah.
Perfect.
Absolutely.
All right. We're talking today with Danica Rome, candidate in the Democratic primary for House District 13 in Virginia, hoping to become the party's nominee and then unseat super anti-LGBT 25-year incumbent term limits, Bob Marshall, in November. When we come back, we're going to dig into Danica's platform a little bit more, find out what we can do to help her succeed in this race. And if time allows, we can take some listener questions. If anybody's listening in on Spreaker, you're welcome to shoot us a question in the chat room, and we'll get around to those when we can. Stick around. More Sarah Talk coming right up.
Hey guys, let's play some video games.
This new dad plays video games with his sons, but the challenge feels like he's lifting a metric ton.
So many buttons!
His avatar just stares at the walls, twists and turns and somehow falls.
Help me!
He's tangled up in the controller's cords.
I just don't understand this crazy digital world.
Crazy, crazy digital world.
Zeros and ones.
But the love from his kids is totally apparent. Ooh. See, you don't have to be perfect to be the perfect parent.
You should have just played catch. You don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. Thousands of siblings in foster care will take you just as you are. For more information on how you can adopt, visit AdoptUSKids.org. A public service announcement from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, AdoptUS Kids, and the Ad Council.
You're busy, I'm busy, we're all busy. And that's why I listen to podcasts, and it's probably why you listen to podcasts too. And that's why I use Audible, and I know you're going to love it too. I love to read, but I also have two rowdy kids and a crazy third shift job and putting together material for the show, and that just doesn't leave a lot of free time to read like I used to. Now I can listen to an audiobook in the shower, on the drive to work, and don't tell my boss, sometimes even at work. These are the popular books you've been wanting to read, titles from the New York Times bestseller list, the Oprah Book Club, authors like John Grisham, J.K. Rowling, Carrie Fisher's The Princess Diarist. Here's one I know you'll want to hear. A gray totalitarian world dominated by Big Brother and its vast network of agents, including the Thought Police. A world in which news is manufactured according to the authorities' will and people live tepid lives by rote. Sound familiar? George Orwell's 1984 has found new meaning in the Trump era, and yes, it's available right now at Audible. Audible has over 180,000 titles in every genre, classics, biographies, science fiction, romance, mysteries, you name it. As a Sarah Talk listener, Audible is offering you a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you the opportunity to check out their service. What free book will you choose? Orwell's 1984, the Harry Potter series? Here's my suggestion. Many of you listen to this podcast for our criticism of religion and outspoken atheism. Start with God is Not Great, How Religion Poisons Everything by the late Christopher Hitchens. Then send me an email. Let me know what you think. Take advantage of this special promotion, a free audiobook and a free 30-day trial. Go to audibletrial.com/saratalk and download your free audiobook today. That's audibletrial.com/saratalk. Welcome back to Sarah Talk. I'm your host, Sarah Austin. Our guest today is Danica Rome. She is running for Virginia House of Delegates, District 13. Let's move on and talk a little bit more about your platform and what we need to do to help you unseat Republican Bob Marshall. These issues, Route 28, vacant businesses on Manassas Drive, Manassas teacher salaries, this is real talk. Your platform doesn't come across like the political copy-paste talking points to me, and I really like that. And I think if we learned anything from the presidential election, it's that people on both sides of the aisle are just over this politics-as-usual garbage, and it's clear that you know what your district needs are. Now, transportation, economic development, and education. Let's start with transportation and economic development because they're so interdependent. Sure. Talk about those a little bit. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, sure. So my biggest proposal is calls for fixing Route 28, which again runs between Prince William County and Fairfax County. Now, I'm going to get into a little bit of minutia, so if your listeners can give me just a hot minute here, I'll explain the minutia, and then we can make it a little bit more broad.
Sure.
So the minutia of this is that you have right now a private conglomerate that is going to be tolling Interstate 66. I personally oppose all tolling in Northern Virginia because to me, it's a double tax, especially when we're talking about the HOV lane that currently exists on Interstate 66 that we have already paid for, we'll now have to pay again in order to use it. That to me is not okay. And we would have to pay in Virginia. If you want to purchase an EZ Pass in Virginia without going out of state for it, you have to have a minimum deposit. That's the bottom line. And that's, you shouldn't be required to pay again for something that we have already paid for. So I oppose it. That said, it's going through. The deal's already been negotiated. It's going to happen. So we then at that point say, okay, rather than relitigate the issue, rather than, you know, take it to court, cost however many millions of dollars it is to fight with that, what's the next best option? What's the most pragmatic, practical thing that we can do? Well, part of the deal that Governor McAuliffe struck with them is that they would put, is that the private conglomerate would put $300 million into fixing the Route 28 Interstate 66 intersection so that we can remove the traffic lights and actually turn it into an interchange. That's something I strongly support. Now, at the same time, the Northern Virginia Transportation Authority has already allocated $300 million for that exact same improvement. That means what we can do is free up that $300 million from the NVTA and keep it on 28. Move that money south on 28 so that we can extend to six lanes just south of US 29 so that maybe if the residents tell us this is what would help them the most, we can start taking out some traffic lights, particularly at the Compton intersection, particularly at a couple other intersections over in Centerville, and we might be able to do some red light mitigation down in Yorkshire and into Manassas as well. Those are some really local stuff. There's a lot of residents and a lot of commercial buildings right along 28. And so part of what I've been doing, knocking on doors in that area, is asking people what would make the most sense. And what they've actually told me is, hey, if we move up a traffic light, this would work. You know, and some people are open to the idea of a traffic circle in different spots. Whatever it takes to remove the red light, while at the same time not making life more difficult for the people who live there, that's what I want to pursue. And again, because we have this $300 million that's going to be freed up, we have got to keep that money on Route 28. Now, the NVTA chairman is Coles District Supervisor Marty Noe of Prince William County. His district includes Yorkshire and parts of Manassas. It includes part of Route 28, the part that gets bottlenecked all the time. He has an inherent interest in fixing this problem. I've known him since 2006. I've known Manassas Park Mayor Jeanette Rischel since 2006. I've known Manassas Mayor Hal Parrish since 2006. I've known these people for a long time. I have good working relationships with them based from my time in the newspaper. I know how to talk with them, and I'll be able to, on day one, sit down and say, okay, what is the consensus about what we can do? What has the NBTA Route 28 Steering Committee recommended so far that we are able to implement as soon as possible? What things did they recommend that were a little too far off? What else could we do? You know, for instance, the steering committee said, well, maybe having bike lanes next to 28 is going to be too expensive and too much. And I'm saying, how are we ever supposed to have an alternative to using our vehicles if we don't have the lanes to provide for bicyclists?
Yeah.
How are we ever going to, you know, get our, how are we ever going to stop becoming dependent on our personal cars if we're not giving people options about how they can get to work that isn't related to a vehicle? We have to be able to do that. And if it costs some money to do it, so be it. It's a smart investment because it takes cars off the road. And that's the name of the game right there. We also have to look at extending Godwin Drive out into Centerville, basically from Manassas to Centerville. Now, there's a big issue with that because there's wetlands mitigation that you have to do at a certain part. And you have to make sure that if you extend that roadway, it does not lower property values, and you have to make sure that it eliminates cut through traffic into some of the neighborhoods, because there's a lot of kids in those areas, and we got to keep their local neighborhood streets safe. That stuff that I heard directly from the residents when I was door knocking over off of Copeland Drive, actually. So that sort of stuff right there is what I'm going to be considering when I make whatever transportation public policy announcements that I'll do, assuming I'm elected. Now, all of that said, we can fix the biggest problem that we have in the district, Route 28, as far as fixing the roadway itself without raising taxes. But if we want to actually get more cars off the road, we have to keep the jobs at home. The number one employer of Prince William County residents is the local school system. The number two employer is the county government. But the number three employer is the Department of Defense. Now, we have Quantico Marine Corps Base in Prince William County. It's obviously world famous. We have a lot of active duty military folks who live in Prince William. But we also have a ton of people who every single day commute along I-66 if they're coming out of Haymarket or Gainesville, or Route 28 to get to I-66 if they're coming out of Manassas or Yorkshire, or in my part of Manassas, heading south and then going off 95 or kind of cutting through Clifton to get onto 395 north of Springfield. You have a lot of people who leave the district every day to take their jobs at the Pentagon, to go to Roslyn, to go to Washington, D.C., to go to Tyson's Corner, all those other places in Northern Virginia and Washington, D.C., where they actually get to work. So my proposal is twofold here. If we want to recruit those defense sector jobs, if we want to recruit those high-tech jobs where you physically have to be there to do the work, then the way that we do that is, number one, finding a cost-effective way to extend the Virginia Railway Express westward from Manassas Airport out to Innovation Technology Park. And I hit Innovation over and over again because that's the place that our County Department of Economic Development has targeted as the high-tech area of Prince William County, where we can have these really big paying, you know, high-paying jobs where that employ a lot of people. We lost the FBI headquarters at Innovation because we don't have a mass transit system, a mass rail transit system connected to that area. The FBI had looked at Innovation and said, sorry, we're not going to do it because you don't have a rail line. That should have never have happened. So we've got to extend that. But we also know that when they proposed to extend it 11 miles westward in Haymarket, it was going to cost $660 million, which is just ridiculous. How is that possible for an 11-mile road or an 11-mile rail system? That doesn't make sense to me. So instead, what I recommend is a first-of-its-kind efficiency study where we have students and professors at Virginia Tech, which is an engineering school right in our Commonwealth, look into best practices out of Europe and Asia to figure out why is it that it costs 2 to 10 times less to build, maintain, and operate a rail structure, a rail system over there than it does over here, especially in Europe, where labor unions are stronger than they are here, and that means that they're paid more money. So if labor costs more, then why is it that it's less expensive for them when they have better quality on their rail lines than we do, especially if you're from my area and you have to deal with the metro? And you go, well, something is missing here. Is it because we only have two or three consultants bidding on a project at a time, or private contractors bidding on a project at the same time, and so we don't even know when we're being built? Is maybe that the problem? Who knows? But it's worth looking into from the people who actually specialize in engineering in the first place. So I'm calling for a first-kind innovation efficiency study for bringing out rail. The other issue that we have got to do is we need to encourage our localities to eliminate their B-poll tax, that's business and professional occupancy license tax. How do we do that? Well, if we don't do it, Prince William County stays behind the eight ball because Stafford County to the south of us eliminated its B-poll tax already. Mm-hmm. Now, that taxes items that you already have within your business, so computers, other things like that. You have to pay an annual tax on that if you are, you know, for based on what it's worth, if your company grosses $500,000 or more. Well, we recently raised the cap to get to $500,000, which is great, but at the same time, we're still at a competitive disadvantage with Stafford County because they don't have a B-poll and we do. So my proposal is called for the Virginia Economic Development Department to issue grants to localities to incentivize localities to get rid of their B-poll. Maybe we only do that in Planning District 8, which is Northern Virginia. Maybe we do that statewide. It completely depends on how you want to negotiate it with members of the General Assembly who actually control the purse strings here. But the bottom line on that is that at a time when a lot of conservative legislators say, hey, we're picking winners and losers when we incentivize individual businesses to set up shop in Virginia, what if we take the same approach, but we apply it more broadly to localities? This way, it levels the playing field for a lot of people, and it makes the state as a whole more competitive for businesses to set up shop compared to North Carolina, compared to West Virginia, compared to Maryland, and in fact, compared to the country as a whole. So that's how those two are all linked together here. That's how transportation is linked to economic development, and that's how I've gone in so much depth crafting my public policy proposals here, because I want to show people that it's not just enough to speak in platitudes. It's not enough to just give vague statements saying, I'm going to focus on transportation. So what are you going to do? I don't know. Something. That doesn't get the job done. Delegate Marshall's had 25 years to fix Route 28, and he hasn't gotten it done, because advocating is nice, speaking about stuff is nice, but you have to deliver results at the end of the day. I think by giving a concrete plan that still has room for flexibility within it will give me a lot of negotiating power going into the General Assembly.
You know, talking about the economic development portion of that, if, you know, Bob Marshall has spent so much time introducing legislation against abortion, against the LGBT community, legislation that's also been proven in many other states, one of which you just mentioned that just recently, you know, blew up with North Carolina, that is such a negative against economic development. Businesses don't want to come to states with archaic laws like that.
Yeah, let me talk about that. Thank you so much for mentioning that. So what Sarah's referring to is HB2 out of North Carolina, which is basically... what Delegate Marshall wanted to do this year is the worst part of HB2, the part that discriminates against transgender people, and make it law in Virginia. I said from day one when I got into this campaign that he once again was introducing go-nowhere, dead-on-arrival legislation instead of focusing on the core priorities of the 13th District. And what happened when the subcommittee finally considered the 5-2 majority, the 5-2 Republican majority on the subcommittee killed the bill, and then killed another anti-trans bill also. So HB 1662 and HB 2011. Actually, I think it was HB 1612. I'm sorry. Yeah. So HB 1612 and HB 2011, both of those died. by the Republican majority. And you go, okay, even they know this is bad. One of the subcommittee members actually said, well, you know, I like the idea of the law, but after what North Carolina what happened in North Carolina, I just don't think it's a good idea for Virginia. It's like, you know, at least that was a guy who said, even if he can't protect our civil rights, he can at least leave us alone.
Yeah.
Just like I was saying before. And you go, well, why did he waste so much of his time and our tax dollars on his salary pursuing go-nowhere, dead-on-arrival legislation instead of focusing on transportation, instead of focusing on raising teacher pay? And, well, I went to his press conference that he had down there before the bill was heard in subcommittee. And a reporter asked him and said, hey, according to Forbes, this is this cost North Carolina $600 million. This cost a lot of jobs, cost a lot of else. You know, why is it that, you know, what you're saying that Forbes said North Carolina is the number two state for business now and all these other platitudes about North Carolina, when the facts of the matter are North Carolina clearly sustained economic damage from this bill? And he said, well, the Forbes story I cited was written by a Forbes staff member. The Forbes story you cited was written for Forbes, so they're not the same.
Oh,
one of them, he called it fake news. He said it was fake news. I'm a journalist. I've been dealing with freelance reporters for 10 and a half years. If my newspaper publishes a story and it's from a staff member or if it's from a freelance writer and we publish it under our name, it's our story at the end of the day. It doesn't matter if it came from a freelancer or if it came from a staff writer. The facts are still the facts at the end of the day. And at the end of the day here, North Carolina lost not just $600 million, not just thousands of jobs, but also the job of the Republican governor who supported it.
Mm-hmm.
Let's get real here. The more we focus on bills like HB 2 and bringing those to Virginia, the more we make Virginia a less competitive state to do business. And by the way, the more we make Virginia a more discriminatory state, which we have a horrible history of that we're finally around to overcoming at this point. Neither of which is okay. We should not be discriminating against our own citizens, and we shouldn't be making Virginia a less business-friendly state than it already is. I mean, we're a very pro-business state in one regard in terms of low taxes, but in other regards, when you have social legislation like that that comes out that says, well, hey, you're a Fortune 500 company, and you have a LGBT CEO or someone on top, you're not welcome here. That's wrong. We shouldn't be doing that. And one of the other things I look at that and say, okay, you want proof that this cost North Carolina? What happened when the NCAA moved some of its, not 1A tournaments, but 2A tournaments, or actually, well, I guess further down, and moved those tournaments to Salem?
Yeah.
The mayor of Roanoke went to bat for the neighboring city of Salem to make sure that they got those tournaments coming in.
And what amazing things that's going to do for their economy.
Right. Virginia directly benefited from North Carolina's blunder, which they still haven't corrected
yet. Yeah.
Virginia cannot take the same backwards, kick-in-the-face approach to governing that North Carolina did. North Carolina was recently called, what was it, like, not even a democracy at this point?
Mm-hmm.
It's just like it's so poorly managed. Virginia is usually among the best managed states in the country. And being among the best managed states in the country doesn't mean we discriminate against our own citizens. Now, look, Delegate Marshall, he got the referendum on marriage passed in 2006. I think it was like a 57-43 majority on that. Times have changed in the last 11 years.
A lot.
From the time that I voted against that ballot measure then, to last year, 10 years later, for the first time in 17 years, a constitutional amendment was defeated by the voters,
mm-hmm.
and it would have enshrined the so-called right to work in Virginia, which is just basically an anti-union bill.
Yep.
That died in Virginia. What happened? We used to say that our cherished right to work law, we used to call it just the most lavish, nice things possible because it's pro-business, it's pro-this. Now, the same people that voted for Donald Trump in southwestern Virginia and the same people that voted for Hillary Clinton in Arlington both rejected that because they said this isn't fair to workers. They say, we already have a law. Why do we have to enshrine it into the Constitution? Whatever their rationale was, you have the same union workers who work in coal fields down in southwestern Virginia saying, hey, look, our social values might not line up with yours in Northern Virginia, and so we might vote for a different presidential candidate. But when it comes to protecting workers and making sure that we all have, you know, a living wage, no, we're on the same side. Mm-hmm. And so what that shows is that a core democratic value of protecting the worker translates across geography, no matter if you're in a culturally conservative area or if you're in a culturally liberal area. And that's important. That's for us to know. That's how we know our state has fundamentally changed since 2006. We have voted for the Democratic nominee for president three consecutive times now, and we hadn't done that since 1964.
Wow.
Virginia has changed. And why has it changed? Because we have a lot of new folks come in. A lot of new folks from all over the country have moved to Virginia because Governor Mark Warner and Governor Tim Kaine, who are now both senators, worked to make Virginia a welcoming environment for so many more people. And it's just like at this point, we have got, like I said before, we've got to make Virginia the most inclusive commonwealth it can be. Why? Because we are uniquely situated to make Virginia the most welcoming state to do business, to retire, to relax, to learn, to enjoy the outdoors in the entire Mid-Atlantic, because we, let's just look at it this way. North Carolina has low taxes and regressive social policies. Maryland has high taxes but progressive social policies. Virginia can be the best of all worlds,
yeah,
with progressive social policies and low taxes. We can be that state. We can do that. Delaware is kind of like that, but it has a very small population by comparison. Virginia is a national leader in so many different fields, and we should be a leader in social progress, and we should be a leader in bringing businesses to our commonwealth.
Well, in the third of your major platform items is another thing that encourages people to move to your area and develop their businesses there, education. We've seen that batshit crazy Betsy DeVos in the Secretary of Education confirmation hearing. She came under some fire for her opinions on school choice, vouchers, and the Christianization of public school systems. Having never attended public school herself, she's gotten a lot of criticism about that. And as I understand, correct me if I'm wrong, you went to private religious schools as well. What is it about...
For 13 years.
Yeah.
I did public schools from K to third grade at Loch Lomond Elementary School in Manassas. And I did private Catholic schools from fourth grade all the way through graduate college. Yeah. And that's not because we had a lot of money, by the way.
Yeah, right. Well, what is it about the education system there in Virginia specifically then that brought that into your platform as a major initiative? And then how do you respond to the people that might say, you don't have the experience with the public school system to make decisions like that?
Okay, a few things. Number one, let me just say how proud of Senator Kaine I am for how he handled Betsy DeVos during the confirmation
hearing.
He showed what happens when you're a 17-year civil rights attorney and you go up against someone who's clearly not qualified for the job. His interview of her, his questioning of her, was just it was just, this is how it's done. This
yeah.
is how being a senator is supposed to work. Asking tough questions and keeping them accountable when they try to dodge. All she would say over and over and over again was just, you know, I support accountability. I support accountability. Yeah, but do you specifically support here? And then when she would still dodge, he would say, okay, I support this. Do you? A nice yes or no question. And she couldn't answer it.
Right.
And when that happens, when you see that dodge and you can't answer a yes or no question, it completely undermines your candidacy. Tim Kaine did outstanding exposing just how poorly qualified she is for that job. So bravo, Senator Kaine.
Agreed. Absolutely.
Great. So meanwhile, moving on here. The biggest issues that we face in terms of education in Prince William County, there's actually several issues, but number one, like I said before, is our teacher pay is thousands of dollars less than it even is in the city of Manassas, which is right. I mean, you can't. Basically, Prince William County completely engulfs the city of Manassas and city of Manassas Park until Manassas. Actually completely engulfs city of Manassas and city of Manassas Park. So, in order to get to those localities, you actually have to go through Prince William County. Well, when we look at teacher pay in our areas, it's like, how is it that it's $5,000 or more dollars less in Prince William for a teacher who's, you know, been teaching for 4 to 5 years than it is in nearby jurisdiction? I talked to a teacher who told me that, you know, the county wasn't letting him transfer his experience from the city of Manassas over. That was a problem. And you go, well, that doesn't make sense. Why, if we want to recruit the best and brightest teachers, if we want to retain the best and brightest teachers, we have to adequately pay them.
Yep.
That's the bottom line. And you pay them, and the way that you adequately pay them is by having more commercial development within the county, by bringing in those high-paying dollar jobs to Innovation Technology Park, because a company of that size, whether it's a federal government institution or if it's a private company, this level, the size of the jobs that we would have there, the size of the companies that would come in, we would get a lot of commercial real estate tax from them, from each company that comes in. And so, and those workers that would be there, if they came from out of the area, they would still be taking lunch in Prince William County. They would still be contributing to our local economy, which is great.
Mm-hmm.
And so our ability to pay for teachers, our ability to deal with overcrowding in schools, which is a big issue on both the western side of the county and the eastern side of the county, that's the sort of stuff that is directly tied to commercial development and being able to bring high-paying jobs into the area. So with overcrowding, on the western end, that's a big problem with some of our high schools and especially with some of our middle schools. On the eastern end, it's a big problem with a lot of our elementary schools. And while that is mostly a local fight between school board members and Board of County Supervisors and members against each other, I'm not wading into that mess. What I will say instead is that the state can secure CIP money, so capital improvement project money, to help move those projects along, to help accelerate them. The same way that Chuck Colgan brought the Northern Virginia Community College to Manassas and to Woodbridge, the same way that Chuck Colgan helped recruit George Mason to set up over in Manassas, the same way that he brought in so much money for public schools over the years, the budgeting mechanisms are already there for us to bring home more money to Prince William and to Manassas Park. They already exist. It just takes political leadership to get it done. Now, some of the other issues that we have, Prince William County is a very diverse county. We have about just under 25% of our population, roughly, is foreign-born. About one-third of our population speaks a language other than English when they're at home. And so we have to make sure that all students in Prince William County have accessible education, accessible public education, so that everyone gets the same fair shot. And a school on the eastern end of the county that's in a minority neighborhood shouldn't be treated differently than a school on the western end of the county that's not in a minority neighborhood. But at the same time, we can say, hey, as a delegate, as anyone else, what can we do to level the playing field to make sure that the kids on the western end of the county are being taken care of as they are now? Because a lot of parents on the western end of the county are very involved in their children's lives, are very involved in their PTAs, and they're very active within government. We need to make sure that that translates on the eastern end of the county, too, so that parents are very involved with their kids' school lives, especially. So part of what we can do here to help that is, one, making sure that we actually have accessible pre-K available all throughout the county, so that every child in Prince William County has a shot at pre-K. Tim Kaine had talked about that in 2005 when he was running for governor. He was still lieutenant governor the first time I interviewed him. That was something where he got pre-K expanded throughout Virginia, but we never got universal access. And I look at that and I say, well, West Virginia has universal pre-K.
Yeah.
West Virginia is a lot poorer than we are. West Virginia took care of that all through all 55 of their counties, or 54, I can't remember which number. How come we can't do that here when we have a lot more money? And by the way, another issue with West Virginia, it's not tied to schools, but I look at this and I say, hey, West Virginia's minimum wage is $8.75 an hour. In Virginia, ours is $7.25 an hour.
Wow.
How is that possible that in an area as wealthy as Northern Virginia, where the cost of living is exponentially higher than it is in West Virginia, that they have a higher minimum wage than we do? Mm. Last summer, I worked weekends away from my newspaper job for a restaurant in Arlington, pulling in $5 an hour plus tips as a delivery driver, because here's what a lot of people need to understand. Even when you have 10 years of journalism experience, even when you've worked for the National Journal, worked for Yoke Alliance, worked for newspapers in Virginia and in Maryland, when you're transgender, it's hard to find a job.
Yep.
It's hard to find a job. I got a lot of those jobs before I come out. And I had applied for over 30 different jobs before, you know, anyone would bite. So there came a point where I was out of time. I needed second income. I needed it as fast as I could. So I took a weekend delivery job.
Mm-hmm.
I know how hard it is to live on that salary. I know how hard it is to make it in an area that's as expensive as ours. And we've got to treat our workers well. And at the same time, we've got to make sure that everyone has the same shot to succeed in our schools. Prince William is amazing, amazing when it comes to allowing a world-class education for children in terms of the programs, the specialty programs that we allow, or that we have, like between the International Baccalaureate program at Stonewall Jackson High School, between the Cambridge program at Brentsville District High School, the robotics program at Battlefield High School. There's so many different specialized programs that we have and specialty just academic courses that so many students can take as long as they're, you know, willing to work hard and achieve it. We've got to make sure that everyone starts strong, so that everyone in our county has the same ability to have that opportunity come high school, not just the people who were taken care of the best when they were kids. Everyone's got to have that same shot.
That's the American dream, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
All right,
we've got to make sure we have accessible public education.
So we're coming up. We've just crossed over an hour here. I want to be respectful of your time as well. So we'll wind up here. And I wanted to say, you know, we do have kind of an international audience, and but our statistics do show that we have some folks connecting from Virginia as well. So, hey, Virginia. But I wanted to have you. I wanted to have you on the show specifically because so many of the things you're working on really are universal. The many municipalities, states, even at the national level, these issues, transportation, economic development, education, people are working on those issues throughout the U.S. and beyond. And so I think it's helpful to get that out there just in the webosphere in general. And you've been extremely effective, and I'm so proud of you for this, about not letting this turn into Danica, the trans woman who's running for office, right? And in some ways,
that's going to be the headline no matter what.
I
accept that. That is part of my identity. It is not the totality of what I want to achieve in government. But I also understand that by being the first transgender person ever to run for the Virginia General Assembly, I'm in a unique position right now to inspire a lot of people who need to have their voices heard too.
Absolutely. And to say that, yes, I am, but come on, we've got work to do. I love that.
It's yes, I am, and we have work to do.
Yeah.
That's one of the things that I want to change in terms of how we talk about LGBT people and issues, is not that we can only succeed despite our gender.
Mm.
We can succeed because of our gender with the authenticity of ourselves. That's how we can succeed. And we should not have to separate one from the other.
That's brilliant. I love it. Where can we find out more about you?
Okay, so there's a few places. I'm on Facebook at Danica Rome for Delegate. That's spelled D-A-N-I-C-A. Last name is R-O-E-M for Delegate. And that's D-E-L-E-G-A-T-E. You can find me at DanicaForDelegate.com. D-A-N-I-C-A-F-O-R-D-E-L-E-G-A-T-E. .com. I'm on Twitter at PWC Danica. That's Prince William County. So PWC Danica on Twitter. Also, if anyone would like to help, right now we have done absolutely amazing in January in terms of volunteers, in terms of fundraising. We have not solicited a single corporate donor. We have not asked for, we're applying for PAC help eventually, but right now, everything that has come into us has been from small dollar donors, from the same people that contribute $27 to Bernie Sanders' campaign, yeah, to other, you know, to other people who understand the power of people-powered politics.
Yes.
The idea that if you can only give a dollar or $5, that still buys me office supplies.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can contribute $500, that helps me pay my campaign manager's salary when he comes on board at the end of this week. And so we have received more than 190 donations, totaling more than $9,100 in 28 days of campaigning. Here's what I need from everyone listening out there today. I want that talking point badly, that in our first month, and we launched on January 3rd, so we didn't have 2.5 days of campaigning at the beginning of the month, that by the end of January, we raised $10,000 from people contributing between $1 and $500. I want that talking point badly. And you can donate, you can help out the campaign by going to danicafordelegate.com, danicafordelegate.com. Our ActBlue fundraising page is right there. There's a contribution link also on our Facebook page at Danica Rome for Delegate. And if you go on the Twitter page, you'll immediately find fundraising links as well. I'm telling you, we have the ability to have a people-powered campaign. Now, keep in mind, our campaign, we have to raise $440,000 to win a seat that pays $17,640 for a part-time legislative position.
Yeah.
So, obviously, our electoral system is broken. Obviously, we need to change it. But we can only change it by getting into it, by actually getting into the system, and then working for automatic voter registration like they have in Oregon by one of my heroes, Governor Kate Brown, who had championed that when she was Secretary of State, by having that sort of universal access to voting for U.S. citizens, which we need to obviously distinguish, apparently, in U.S. politics now, given the present administration, in order to make that substantial change, and in order to fundamentally change, not just in Virginia, but throughout the United States, how we talk about LGBTQ issues, in order to fix Route 28, in order to bring high-paying jobs to Innovation Technology Park, in order to raise our teacher pay, we have to win this race this year. This is the year to do it. The numbers are there to win. On Saturday alone, we had 25 volunteers show up to help us canvass and collect petition signatures throughout the Mullen precinct in Manassas for a House of Delegates candidate in January. That is unheard of. That doesn't happen.
That's awesome.
There is excitement and enthusiasm around our campaign. And then what happened after that? Immediately after I got done with canvassing there, I went to a house party at Heritage Hunt, which is a 55 and older neighbor our area. It's the largest precinct within the 13th district. I only knew one person who was there, and it wasn't even the hostess. She had brought more than 20 other people into her house. I had no idea this was happening. To listen to me talk about policy, to sign our petition signature, or to sign our petitions, and to donate.
Wow.
And that one day alone, we raised $800, just between people donating $25 to $300. Again, this is not people buying us. I'll never take a donation from Dominion Virginia Power, the utility company I was talking about at the beginning of the show,
mm-hmm.
ever. I'll never take it, whether I'm in government or whether I'm running for governor. I will never take a campaign contribution from them. Because these utilities, especially in Northern Virginia, have to be looked at objectively. We cannot say, well, you're funding my campaign. Delegate Marshall's taken more than $7,000 from them. He's been he has advocated for some of the same positions that I have regarding Dominion, but at the same time, it's like you can't take the money at any given point from Dominion, because we have to make it clear to them that they can't buy access within our government. This is really, really important. But we can uniquely accomplish right now for all people listening out there is having a people-powered, small-dollar donor campaign that cuts through the noise, gets us elected, and allows us to create fundamental change that benefits the people of the 13th District and changes the narrative nationwide. This is the race to do it. This is the year to do it. We don't have to wait until 2020 to send a signal to the president. We don't have to wait until 2018 to send a signal to the president. We can do it this year in 2017 by defeating someone who endorsed him last year. Let's do this. Let's get this done.
Right on. Now, we'll obviously, we'll do all we can to help amplify your messages. And we'll include links on the show notes of this episode. This is episode 40. Danica, thanks for taking some time with us today. I really appreciate you being flexible with my, I have a last minute dentist appointment and I don't know what time I'm going to be home. So I really appreciate that. And
all good. No problem. No problem at all, Sarah. It was so nice to talk to you. And thank you so much for reaching out in the first place.
My pleasure.
I want to close by giving you one quick story about why this matters beyond the district boundaries.
Please do.
In our first week, I received a message from a mother who had a 10-year-old daughter who decided that she was finally ready to present as her female self at school right after the election. She decided this was going to be it, no matter who was going to win. Her daughter's transgender and was finally ready to just present. The mother tells me that after she came out at school, she got beaten up, physically beaten up by three other girls.
Oh,
the father of one of the girls, she told me, berated the family. And yet the kid still shows up. She still shows up in her dress. She still shows up in her stockings at school. And the mother closed the email by saying, "You are giving us hope."
Yeah.
Every person out there who's listening to this, by helping out the campaign, you are giving me hope so I can keep inspiring people like that. And they keep inspiring me. You will never see me on a platform. I have a campaign platform, but you'll never see me elevated beyond the peer, beyond being able to have a one-on-one conversation with someone, whether I know them or not. Let's keep this rolling. We are making a giant difference throughout the country, not just the 13th District right now, and I need your help.
Couldn't agree more. Danica, again, thank you so much for being with us today, and we wish you well in your campaign.
Thank you so much, Sarah. Take care.
Thanks, you too. We'll definitely be following along with Danica, and we'll love to we'll try to check in with her from time to time as well. Danica Rome, the Democratic candidate for Virginia House of Delegates in District 13. Again, please visit danicafordelegate.com, and we'll have links on the show notes for that. To learn more about Danica, her platform and positions, and to make a campaign contribution. Over the next few weeks, again, we're still working to hammer out our interview with Buck Angel, adult filmmaker, trans man, and icon within the community. Next week, we have a scheduled special guest host, Michael Kaplan, my hairstylist. No, we won't be doing a live cut and color, though that would make for some damn exciting radio, wouldn't it? Michael is an out gay man, but wasn't always so, like so many. We'll ask him about his self-acceptance and coming out, and the divides within the LGBT community, and so much more. He's a total freak, so you can expect that that show will be completely not safe for work. As always, thank you for listening and supporting our show. We'll see you on the next one. You've been listening to Sarah Talk.
Sarah Talk is made possible by listener support. Visit patreon.com/saratalk to become a patron and help keep this program going. Contact Sarah and company by email at producer@saratalk.com or call 224-40-SARAH. That's 224-407-2724. And follow us on social media, facebook.com/saratalkradio and on Twitter @saratalkradio. Sarah Talk is a production of Sarah Austin Media.